Welcome back to another Meet Kevin Report. We're on episode 86. It is April 18th. We've got some little things we're going to start with here in the intro, and then we'll jump on over into a couple segments. First, Lululemon is apparently selling off their mirror business. They actually fully wrote that down in Q4. That should boost some profits going forward. The earnings per share might actually end up higher for Lulu if they end up selling the mirror business, since they basically wrote it down to zero. Anything they sell it for would end up boosting EPS. Yes, David's Bridal is going bankrupt for the second time now, but this time they actually hope to go bankrupt and close all 300 stores, filing for Chapter 11, a reorganization in New Jersey, although I wonder why they would be going Chapter 11 if they're planning to close all their stores. There's a potential that they're trying to go online only. We'll see what happens there. Tesla, according to Barron's, is deemed to have a $10,000 cost advantage compared to GM, Toyota, and Ford, helping explain why Tesla can be aggressive with price cuts while at the same time maintaining margins, though margins are going to be exactly what we're looking at earnings tomorrow for Tesla. And we don't expect them to be as great as they used to be, at least for now, while we still have some lingering expensive supply chain costs. Bloomberg Intelligence surveyed a bunch of economists and believes that 96% of people surveyed, or economists surveyed, believe that if we end up defaulting on our debt, the stock market will crash anywhere between 0 to 10%. It'll definitely go down. Many more think it'll crash substantially more than that. So fingers crossed and knock on wood that we end up passing the debt ceiling, because it could be a nice catalyst to the downside, which isn't great. Then we've got to talk about winners and losers. And this is sort of a piece that I've been building for a while here. And so we'll start with some data, and then we'll get into some of my thoughts on what this actually might mean for this craziness of the recession that we've been talking about. So let's get, oh dear Lord, I'm going to spill coffee everywhere. Let's get started with the first segment following the intro here. So intro, and then we'll call that the winners and losers. All right, we'll go with 30 seconds after. All right, stand by. Well, there's been a lot of talk about recession, and yesterday my team and I had a big discussion putting together as much of the data we could, and we had a really crazy thesis that we wanted to run by everyone, because you know I'm always trying to look ahead at what's going on. I was one of the first YouTubers to actually sell when it was time to sell at the beginning of 2022. I was one of the first to call for the Nike Swoosh recovery, which knock on wood so far is doing well. But wait a minute, the yield curve is so inverted. You've got office real estate collapsing. Credit Karma says 1 in 5 people aged 59 and older say they didn't have a retirement account, and 27% say they have nothing at all set aside for their later years. You've also seen baby boomers, 17% of them, decreasing their contributions to their retirement accounts due to inflation. You've got 41% of Gen Z and 38% of millennials saying their net worth is zero or negative. Yes, that's literally what's happening to people. When you've got 4 out of 10 Gen Z or millennials sitting with a zero or negative net worth, people are robbing their retirements because of inflation, and we believe that a recession is afoot. In other words, recession should be here if it's not here already. Except what's actually happening? Well, what's actually happening is things are mostly still booming. In fact, we were supposed to have a bad earnings season, but according to Bank of America, of the 30 S&P companies that have already reported during this earnings season, 90% have beat on the bottom line, 73% have beat on sales. And despite the fact that banks are supposedly tightening, it seems like people continue to spend more money on their credit and debit cards. At least when you look at JPM's earnings, it's exactly what you see. People are spending more on discretionary goods, despite the fact that we're supposed to be in a recession. And this is something that even Wells Fargo echoed, that people are spending more despite the idea of this recession. Now, on one hand, we make the argument that, okay, well, that'll be a limited candle. In other words, We'll have this candle of excess savings that we saved up. And once we burn through that, then we'll really have this mind-blowing, suffering recession. Maybe not, though. And this was the thesis we talked about yesterday. That is, maybe not. What if this recession is actually a recession of winners and losers? In other words, on one hand, you have wealthier individuals with exposure to stocks who were able to increase their allocation to some of their favorite stocks during the crisis. Maybe they were able to increase their exposure to certain businesses or opportunities that they were able to build during the crisis of the last year and a half. Maybe they were able to weed their businesses of talent that didn't end up being productive talent, and they were able to become leaner and actually boost up their margins and become a stronger company. And so therefore, on one hand, you have the winners. But then on the other hand, you have the losers, which might end up being office commercial real estate, which we think the time bomb of office real estate is going to destroy the entire real estate market. More on that in a moment, because it might not exactly be what we think, although technically it should be. We'll talk about it. But in addition to office, you might have people with lower incomes who, yeah, have seen their wages rise, but in real terms, which means inflation-adjusted terms, we've actually seen their incomes go net negative. So yeah, you might work at Walmart, instead of making $14, now make $18, but thanks to inflation, you're actually not any further ahead, even though it feels like you're making more money. So the losers could really be those heavily affected by inflation, which are people who spend most of their money on expensive things, like, expensive necessities, food, gas, and rent. All three of those absolutely destroying lower income individuals. Whereas on the other hand, businesses are able to refine, wealthier individuals are spending through the recession, and if the stock market stages a recovery and most of real estate dodges the bullet of an office disaster, maybe this is not so much of a broad-based recession, but rather it's a recession for some and a victory lap for others. Consider the following, and this is something we yesterday were really thinking hard about, and this has to do with real estate, because we continue to hear that, hey, office real estate is supposed to destroy the entire real estate market, and that's mostly because we continue to see defaults on office. In fact, just yesterday, we had more default announcements. Consider the following. Just yesterday, we ended up seeing a Los Angeles-based Brookfield asset manager default on two more, they originally defaulted on two office buildings in Los Angeles. Then they just defaulted on 12 offices that they hold in Washington, D.C. Just defaulted on $161 million of mortgages. We're going to stop paying. We'll give the keys back to the bank. And a lot of people scratch their heads here and say, How is this possible? How are some people losing so much money in real estate? And how is this not going to affect the broader market? In fact, you're even seeing some of it extend over to multifamily. Consider this. You've got a Houston apartment owner, according to the Wall Street Journal, who's now facing foreclosure after losing four complexes with over 3,200 units. It's the Apples Way Investment Group that borrowed $230 million that just got hit with a refinance. Can't refinance because rates are 2 to 3 times as high as they were. And what now? Now they're going into foreclosure. And so the question here is, wait a minute, isn't this a sign of what's to come? If the real estate market collapses, won't that pull everything else down? Well, let's think about that for a moment. So here's how this usually works. Ordinarily, what happens is if you have a certain segment of the real estate market, let's say you have office here and multifamily. We'll do these separately for a moment here. And there goes the HDMI connection. Stand by for Kevin to fix the HDMI connection. Okay, I think I fixed it. Let's say you have office. And let's say office starts collapsing. And office actually does collapse. Let's go with that. Some office valuations are already down as much as 35%. So what happens when office prices go down? Let's go extreme. And let's say that prices go down 50%. Well, what happens when prices go down is you generally see a cap rate, which is basically your yield, go up. So when that yield goes up, it should become more attractive compared to other deals, usually because rents don't fall that fast. So in other words, you're in the situation where, okay, prices fell because that office space maybe was originally less desirable. But once the price falls to a certain point, the yield should go up. And even if rents have to be adjusted a bit, somebody else should be able to come in and buy them. And those people who usually come in to buy that office space tend to be substituting the other real estate they're buying. Maybe they were originally buying multifamily or retail or industrial, and they substitute those purchases for now heavily discounted office space because the yields are higher, right? Well, that's usually what happens, which usually drives the entire real estate market down because you've lost money at office, and then you move money from other segments to office. But that's not actually necessarily what needs to happen, much like the broader economy. You could actually have, and look at this analogy here, you could actually have the winners, and then you could have the losers. Just like you could have those who are highly affected by inflation on one side, and those not affected by inflation on the other side. But wait a minute, how might that work? Well, the way this could actually work in real estate is you could potentially see office space be written down and become a lot less desirable because as those prices go down, maybe those rents are also equally driven down. Those cap rates don't actually become more desirable. And the best thing to do with a lot of 1960s, 50s, 70s office buildings that aren't desirable for condo conversions or aren't functional for new office spaces, those office spaces just go away. They get demolished. They get deleted. In other words, these become the losers. So people investing over here have invested in the losing side of this recession, and this really just disappears, leaving the multifamily and the other sectors, maybe even single family, really unscathed because of the disaster of office. So in other words, you have this tale of two cities of a recession, potentially, where on one side, you have office as a loser, and you have people highly affected by inflation, unfortunately, the losers in the economy. Whereas the winners are people, once again, with assets that in time tend to appreciate in value, people with more cash, businesses that are able to shave off excess workers and refine and increase their margins. And what you end up potentially happening is you end up getting no real recession. In other words, if you get a recession, it's potentially so delayed that it doesn't matter. Consider this. Estimates for a recession were originally that we were supposed to go into recession in Q3, Q4 of 2022. Those ended up getting pushed back to Q3 to Q4 of 2023. Now the market is saying, oh, we might not actually be in a recession until Q1 of 2024. Well, what happens if the recession, this looming recession, doesn't actually hit until Q4 2024? Well, let me ask you, if the recession doesn't technically hit until Q4 of 2024, are high margin businesses going to care? Are profitable real estate investments going to care? Are higher net worth individuals going to care? Unlikely. They likely won't care. In that case, means there's also the potential that you have a tale of two cities in the stock market and the real estate market, where potentially on one side, let's say inflation is back at 2% when this recession hits, right? Well, if inflation is back at 2% when this delayed recession hits, Federal Reserve could turn on the money printer to try to help the poorer folks again, right? The Fed tries to help basically the losers. But what then happens is when you turn on the money printer, we already know what happens. It's actually not the poorer people who win because we know trickle-down economics doesn't work that well. You get maybe $100 that gets showered down and $90 goes over to the winner side and $10 goes over to the losing side. Why? Because again, when you turn the money printers on, who wins? It's people with assets. It's people who have stocks and real estate and businesses. Those are the people who regularly win. So the question that we discussed yesterday was, wait a minute, if this recession continues to get delayed, then what you actually have is the winners continuing to win in the meantime. As we ramp up for this recession, businesses have the luxury, dare I say, of cutting unproductive workers under the guise of a coming recession. Look at Ernst Young, just fired 5% of their staff, and they're in consulting, which makes you wonder, hey, wait a minute, these are a lot of layoffs, and tech is laying off to the tune of hundreds of thousands, it seems, for the last 6 to 8 months. Yet, when we actually look at employment reports, both ADP and the Bureau of Labor Statistics, technically we're actually gaining jobs on a monthly basis rather than losing jobs. So is it possible then that as the velocity of money starts actually and ironically and surprisingly increasing rather than decreasing, yeah, we might be seeing job loss, but is it possible that we're creating more productivity in this prep for a recession so we can barrel through the recession time? Look at the velocity of money right now. If you go to St. Louis Fred and you look at the velocity of money, usually what you would expect in a quantitative tightening cycle is that the velocity of money would be falling. And that's because people are tightening. People have less availability for lending. People are turning inward. They're spending less money. But if you actually look at the velocity of money, what you see happening is the velocity of money has started increasing as of the fourth quarter, which makes you wonder, did the velocity of money, with all this money printing that was done, really just fall substantially below this declining trend to where we could actually see ourselves through a recession as the velocity of money picks up again, leading to greater GDP, especially amongst those winners? Yeah, it's possible. Now look, the inverted yield curve technically hasn't been wrong in the past. The inverted yield curve says a recession is definitely going to happen, but it doesn't tell us when a recession is going to happen. And it certainly doesn't tell us when the stock market is going to bottom. In fact, if we go into history, the stock market usually bottoms before the end of a recession. And if you have a short recession, you can end up having a stock market bottom quite substantially early. In fact, take a look at this chart here. This shows that the S&P 500 actually bottomed as far as 9 months before the bottom of a recession in July to May of 1953 to 1954. And it shows you that, yeah, the average might be somewhere around 4 to 5 months, but there's no real consistency to say that this couldn't be 18 months or 2 years. It wouldn't be the average, but there's no consistency to say that it couldn't happen if we've once had the stock market bottom 10 months after a recession ended back in 01 when we had the early dot-com recession, or way before, rather, like we had in 53 to 54. So the reality is, sure, might have a recession, but does that necessarily mean stocks have to bottom around that time? No. In fact, in many cases, like when you look at a company like Nike, we've already seen their earnings recession. And this is kind of weird to think about, that the, in many cases, recession could have already been behind us. Look at Nike, for example. Nike's earnings bottomed out with negative year-over-year net earnings for 2 quarters in a row, which means they were in an earnings recession last year when we were in the technical recession. Remember Q1 and Q2 when we had negative GDP? Maybe the technical recession already happened. Or maybe we'll have another minor recession ahead of us. But I'm convinced that we're living in a tale of two cities style reality. And so regardless of what ends up happening with recession yes or recession no, I don't personally think that matters much. What I think that really matters is making sure as individuals, we can do everything that we can in our power to align with the side that's winning. And let's be really clear and provide that practical advice. The practical advice, non-personalized advice, obviously you know this, I'm a licensed financial advisor, I sell courses on building your wealth, I've got affiliate links, you can learn all about those, my ETF, the courses, everything at meetkevin.com, you know that already. But this can't be personalized financial advice because I don't know you. Maybe we could sit down and do an interview one day and then we could do some personalized advice. But the point is, if you want to be a winner in this market, maybe worrying about the recession is actually the wrong strategy. Maybe the strategy needs to be, what can you do to figure out what the losers are and what the winners are? And the losers are very clear. The losers are office real estate, and unfortunately, if your wages are under about the national average, $33 is the national average, and so I would take it maybe a little bit of a standard deviation further and say somewhere around $25. If your wages are under $25, you might have to think to yourself, okay, what can I do to get to a higher level? Maybe the company you're already in has you on a set path where you're going to be making a substantially higher salary in the future. But if you're at a potentially dead-end path, maybe the question is, what can you do to become a professional or create or increase, rather, your exposure to assets? Remember the three assets that matter here: bonds, real estate. I'll say bonds and stocks. So bonds and stocks, for most people, that's going to be stocks, real estate, and then actually owning businesses. So we'll simplify that. Stocks, real estate, businesses. Most people, especially when you're younger, under 40 years old, have the capability of generating some kind of professional license, whether that's a CPA, a lender, a realtor, whatever, has some form of professional designation, substantially increase your income by creating either your own business or working for somebody by making an above average wage, which would be above $33 an hour. Then use that to buy stocks and real estate. And maybe the Nike swoosh holds. The losers continue to be low earners who have negative real wage growth and office space. And maybe we end up with this tale of two cities of winners and losers style recession, where, yeah, office is going to look like it's in a recession. Poorer folks are going to be like, damn, that time sucked. And wealthier people, or people with the assets, the stocks, the businesses, and real estate, are going to go, damn, that was a bitchin' buying opportunity. And what a great opportunity to increase margins at our business by laying off the unproductive workforce. It's the harsh reality. Nothing in this video is designed to be politically correct, you know, suggesting that people who are more affected by inflation are in the losing camp is a financial reality. It's certainly not the politically correct thing to say. But when we start considering that maybe we have this two-city style recession, maybe it means we've got to realign our expectations for this mega crash that's supposed to take down the whole world. Again, everybody's got fears about everything. There are fears about China invading Taiwan. There are fears about the de-dollarization. Rabobank just had a massive piece about the BRICS currency and the potential de-dollarization. And this is something that we've been talking about on the channel as well, this de-dollarization under potentially Joe Biden and potentially some of our weaknesses in the Middle East, Africa, South America, leading to other countries wanting to flee the United States. We've talked about this many times before. And the reality is, a lot of these fears could end up blowing into real problems, right? It is a problem if the dollar loses its reserve status. It's a problem if China invades Taiwan. But I think a lot of these are much more edge case scenarios, like the chance of us defaulting on our national debt, which would probably lead to a substantial decline in the stock market. But we've got to ask ourselves, do we want to be in a situation where we're constantly hedging for this impending recession or all of these potential edge case scenarios? Or do we want to do what we know is tried and true, which is exposing ourselves to stocks, businesses, and real estate, assets, so we could be part of the winning side? Now, of course, the biggest thing that destroys all of this and ends up destroying both sides, and this is the one red flag to both sides. There's one thing that could absolutely destroy both the losing side now and the winning side. There's one thing that destroys both of these sides. And folks, that is resurgent inflation. If for some reason the velocity of money increase that we're seeing ends up not just offsetting the quantitative tightening that we're seeing, or the tightening lending conditions that we're seeing, or the subprime autos market collapsing like we're seeing, if the velocity of money increase here does more than just offset those things, and it actually creates resurgent inflation, then we're screwed. Then the fact is both sides get hammered. Both sides end up getting Paul Volcker. You get people like a Mr. Bullard who end up being right. Mr. Bullard actually just provided some commentary. Let's see what he says. Bullard still sees adequately restrictive policy rate at 5.5 to 5.75% with a bias to hold longer until inflation goes away. Not much clear progress on inflation means interest rates need to continue to rise. He's referring to core inflation, unfortunately still remaining somewhat sticky at 5.6%. It's way too high. We need patience to get to 2%. And hopefully we can get inflation down. And if we get inflation down, which is my base case, that by the end of 2024, we end up getting inflation down, which requires patience, then the asset side will prove to be a winner again, as it historically always has. And the losing side will always be the side that ends up going bankrupt because of a regime change or people who have low wages. Now, regime change in this case is probably just going to be the changing COVID, post-COVID dynamic where people don't want to work out of 1960s, 70s, 80s, 50s offices anymore. And a lot of those buildings are just going to have to get demolished, which sounds crazy because you might think it'd be realistic to turn them into condos. The reality is, it's not. So, that gives you my opinion on the two-sided recession that we might be facing and how to potentially protect yourself. Obviously, if you want to learn exactly how to go from zero to millionaire in real estate, check out the programs linked down below. We've got a course on the stocks and psychology and money as well. The Elite Hustlers Group for building your income, whether you're employed or self-employed, starting a business or otherwise. Check out those programs linked down below. But when it comes to recession, really not terribly worried unless we see the ghost of inflation come back. All right, next up, Vietnam now going to talk about something else. We are going to look at a video and do a reaction to video. All right, let's see what we have here. This is an interesting one. So, that's my more positive winners and losers piece, which I aligned with. But now we got to talk about, what's this dude talking about over at Home Depot? Former Home Depot CEO is losing it again. Well, again, this is the first time we played him on here. But let's take a look at what he has to say. Stand by. Mm-hmm. All right, let's see here. Here we go. All right, let's do this button. Now we gotta talk about... I screwed it up. Sorry. Now we gotta talk about what the former CEO of not just Home Depot had to say, but the former CEO of Chrysler and GE Power. Yeah, three-time CEO, all the same person. And what did he just have to say about what might be coming to the U.S. markets and U.S. companies? Well, take a listen over here because it's something to pay attention to and buckle up for. Listen in to this interview. Here we go. From
Paris, right? These protests, still waiting to hear from a high court.
Stand by.
We had yet.
Where's the interview?
Emmanuel Macron went too far.
What the heck? And took they clickbaited me with something else. This is not the right video. Yeah, no, this is where he ends up coming into the interview. It's just, oh, there it is. Okay, here we go. They're going to make me wait a minute and a half before getting to the actual interview? You jerks! Stand by. All right, here it is.
Very generous benefits, but it's still going to be pretty low as far as Western power standards are concerned. What do you think of what this could mean for us when politicians eventually get around to addressing, you know, strengthening funding for Social Security and Medicare here?
Yeah. Well, good to be with you, Neil, this afternoon. I think you and I have both seen that number rise over our lifetime here, right? So I'm okay at 63, 64, 65, but I do think it will have some backlash here in the United States should that move forward here. Now, it'll be a much different number, but I think there'll be some negative reaction to it also, Neil. I really do.
You know, obviously entitlements have to be addressed. We know that Kevin McCarthy is going to address this whole debt limit issue next week. But he and the president don't seem to be even talking right now about that. And, you know, the clock is ticking. Are you worried about all that?
Yeah, I'm definitely worried about that. And I thought a lot of the comments from Mark were spot on. And I would just reinforce a lot of the points he made. You know, I'm seeing inventory builds in a lot of the businesses, both public and private. Neil, you remember when we spoke in 07, 08, and 09, there was singular focus on the banks, right? Their meltdown took everything down. Today, the banks are doing great, but now we have this mixed messaging. Retail's not doing so well. Banks are doing well. Transportation is up 13.9% over the last 12 months. I think we're in a very complex environment. And, of course, this debt issue only adds to that. It adds to the certainty of uncertainty, what's going to happen. And again, Mark's point about a lot of the small middle market companies that are under tremendous pressure with debt. I think we're going to see a lot of bankruptcies like Bed Bath & Beyond. We got Walmart not only laying people off, but closing stores. We got a lot of Accenture laying people off. We got Amazon closing distribution centers. So I think there's a tremendous mixed message. And the complexity with which we have to deal with this one is different than any I have seen in my 52 years, Neil.
All right. On that, I hope you're wrong. You can look at that same trend, and it's one of the reasons why you have a majority of investors still very leery about the market. That could also be an opportunity that this is as low as we go, and things will turn around because so few are optimistic. Having said that, retail sales did fall more than expected, down 1%. Ex-autos down 0.8%. Slowest growth we've seen since June of 2020. I'm wondering what you make of all of this, because on the one hand, you could talk about that, you know, giving consumers second thoughts about spending. We don't see much evidence of that because their flights are booked and airlines are saying they're very optimistic for a busy summer travel season. Restaurants are packed. Walt Disney World, their site went down as people were booking Walt Disney World vacations. So that doesn't seem to be a worry. So there does seem to be a disconnect here. What do you make of that?
Yeah, no, I think you're spot on, Neil. I mean, if you think about transportation, again, it's up about 13.9% year over year. If you look at bookings, it's up tremendously. If you look at our hometown company here, Delta, is having, tremendous bookings. Ed came on and talked about the future. Hospitality has been one of the biggest job creators over the last couple of months, and you and I have talked about that. But then again, you look at retail, and I can just assure you that we're starting to see more cancellations and leaving us with bigger inventories that we're going to have to try to burn off, or we're going to have to discount to try to get those moved. So, again, it's very mixed messages here. And you talk about auto being up. And again, now we have this administration trying to tell the...
I want to pause for a second. We got like 20 seconds left. But I want to talk about this mixed messaging. Is exactly what we're seeing in this sort of Tale of Two Cities style recession. Where, yeah, some people are getting screwed. Subprime auto is getting screwed. People are getting their cars repossessed. Guess what happens? Then they can't go to work. Can't go to work, what happens? They got to cancel their Magic Kingdom visit. So some of that is happening. Yeah, Amazon distribution centers and Walmart, they're conducting layoffs. A lot of these companies way overhired because it was so hard to hire people. So it was easier to hire a bunch of people and then fire. Now those people have to go find new jobs. Now what's actually really interesting about firing people is you might initially think, oh my God, that's horrible. But the reality is, if somebody is not productive at a job, the best thing the company could do is fire them. The reason for that is twofold. First, let me say the impression. The impression is, oh no, evil company fired somebody. oh no, that means GDP is going to go down because that person has less money to spend, right? Well, that's the impression, but that's generally not the reality. Because what actually happens? Let's say that person works and produces $100 of productivity a day and gets fired because they're paid $300 a day and they only produce $100 of productivity a day. Well, then they get fired. Now, they don't create $100 of productivity a day. So it's like, oh my gosh, the economy lost $100 of productivity a day, right? And the company's saving $300 a day, right? No, the company now has $300 to spend on something else that might create $300 of productivity. And that person probably doesn't stay unemployed. They go find another job. Maybe they're not getting paid $300 anymore. Maybe they're getting paid $200, but they're actually providing $200 of value. Now you actually have a net GDP boon. I mean, think about it. Firing sounds so bad. But when you have firing and still have employment growth, it's actually freaking awesome. Because now the company that fired has more money to spend. Some other company picks the person up and properly values them, hopefully. And if they're not, then they get fired again in the future. And they're just a revolving door. Then maybe the finger points at the individual and not at the companies. So now all of a sudden, that person gets another job. And what happens? GDP actually goes positive. Because both the company that fired and the individual now introduce more productivity into the world. Now, the question is, well, what happens if there are no more jobs to get? But that's not actually what's happening in this economy. Yes, that could happen in some economies, but it's not what's happening in this economy. What's happening in this economy is, yes, you are seeing people get laid off of consulting, people get laid off of tech, and guess what they're having to do? They're having to get lower wage tech or consulting jobs or go into a different industry. Yeah, that might seem like it's a terrible thing, but again, if you're paying a software engineer $200,000 for $50,000 of productivity, they are creating a deadweight loss of $150,000 of potential economic power. The company saves the $200,000, person gets fired, person goes and works a $100,000 job, which is a 50% pay cut, but actually creates $100,000 of value. Now you have $100,000 of value here, $200,000 of value here. You actually have more GDP output. So layoffs are not actually a horrible thing as long as the economy is still functioning, which right now it appears that it is. Really, layoffs are just a sign of what I like to call a rejiggering, right? It's kind of like companies did a bunch of this and then they're like, all right, we got too much. Let's do a little bit of that. All right, now we're good. We're good over here, right? Or you bring on people who actually help create productive margin. You should always, as an individual, whether you're an employee or you're a self-employed or whatever, you should every single day be asking yourself, how much value did I generate today? And then compare that to what you're being paid. And if you got paid, let's say you're working at Walmart, okay? And your job is to do inventory. And you took 17 bathroom breaks and, you know, sent 200 messages or whatever on your phone, and you did maybe an hour worth of inventory work. And maybe you're really good in that hour. Maybe you get paid $20 an hour, but you did $30 worth of work. But the company paid you 200. Well, the company didn't actually pay, I mean, they may have paid you 200, but it cost the company probably 30% more. So it probably cost the company $260 that day for you to basically do $30 worth of work. Well, in such a case, it is in the best interest of the company to do the hard thing and fire that person who's not being productive. Now, there's always the question of like, well, was the person not trained or are they just a misfit, right? Like maybe that's not what they should be doing. Maybe they're not motivated for whatever reason. So this idea of layoffs always being bad is very flawed. It's actually very healthy for businesses to go bankrupt and people to get laid off because it's a wake-up call that you can't keep doing the same thing expecting different results. Bed Bath & Beyond never adapted to really getting into e-commerce. Best Buy did. Best Buy and Bed Bath & Beyond were both on the same path. They were both trending towards bankruptcy. Best Buy's like, we need same-day pickup. We need to have the best customer service possible. We need to have a better return policy. We need to have better CX. We need to have better availability of supply. Our inventory management system has to match. That is, what's in the store has to actually be reflected online, and what's reflected online has to actually be on the store. And we got to get our shit together. And they did. And now Best Buy's killing it. Whereas Bed Bath & Beyond's not. They deserve to go bankrupt. Some businesses don't adapt and they die. Adapt or die. That's evolution. So it's a very normal part of the business cycle. So when I hear about, like, oh my gosh, Bed Bath & Beyond, and there are going to be more bankruptcies. Good. I want more.
Consumer, what they're going to be able to buy going forward, right, Neil, with electric vehicles.
Yeah, they get more and more of those in. But they want, what, 6 out of 10 sales to be that in just another few years. I don't know if we're ready for that because they're just about 1 out of 20. Sales right now. All right, Bob, thank you very much. Hope you have a safe weekend, my friend. Very good seeing you again.
Thank you, Neil, very much. You too.
All right, so that addresses that. Now, a little bit more on layoffs here. You know, Mr. Opsar says here, Kevin doesn't take into account the period of time the replacement worker is unproductive. Who cares? That's called business. You have to wake up and realize that if you run a business and there are unproductive people, well, hopefully you could train them better. And you could try to train them better. Anytime you train people, there's going to be a phase where they are less productive, right? So you have to think about the life cycle of basically somebody at a job. You start at a job, they're extremely unproductive when they start, but they have very high potential. So let's say you pay somebody $100,000 salary. The first 6 months, where it's their first time doing stuff, they're extremely unproductive and they generate $25,000 of value. But then in the future, after 6 months, they generate $200,000 of value. Well, first of all, that it would be incumbent upon the company to eventually give the person a raise, right? $125,000, $150,000. And now all of a sudden, the company is starting to get paid back for the training period, right? But now it's net-net for both sides. The employee gets paid more and the company makes more money. But this idea that, oh, well, you know, we keep giving second chances. Look, I'm all for 2 chances, 3 chances. But at some point, people are not a fit for a company and they got to go. So, you know, I'm a big fan of, hey, you know, 6 months. You know, within 6 months, you know, and then it's time to trade them in. So, I mean, it sometimes people are like, oh, that sounds so insensitive. It's like, that's good for both sides. If a person's working for a company and they're not productive for whatever reason, training, culture fit, the type of work, who cares? They are affecting the U.S. economy. They're sandbagging the U.S. economy because money is being wasted. We don't want waste in the economy. America is so great because we are so operationally efficient. Because you can get fired, you are motivated to work harder. Everybody's not protected by a union, and it's not impossible to fire people. Right? We have a lot of right-to-work states. Like, even California is one. Imagine this. I would say the most liberal state in the country is a right-to-work state, which means you can get fired at any moment for any reason. Well, maybe not any reason. that's in my opinion. How many people have $200,000 salaries and a lifestyle set on a $200,000 job and are laid off and can only get a $100,000 job will not lead to higher GDP? Well, it's a fair question. So let's analyze this. First of all, if you have a $200,000 salary and you're living a $200,000 life and you're at risk of potentially getting laid off because you're not actually providing more value than you're getting paid, or you can't get a replacement job at that sort of salary, that's your own fault. Sorry, that's a harsh reality. That's your fault. That's not the economy's fault. That's your fault. That's why, I mean, it seems like you still have, what, 40% of people living paycheck to paycheck making six-figure salaries? It doesn't make sense. That's not sustainable. So the reality is, people making $200,000 should be aware that, okay, well, what are my other options if I didn't have a job here? And my lifestyle should be conducive to that level of value. So that's always a risk. So that individual should always be prepared for that. I mean, that's just the nature of the world. Now, if the company that was employing them at $200,000 now potentially has to lay them off and then doesn't hire a replacement worker and their earnings go down because that person has their lifestyle cut in half, are earnings going to go down? Absolutely. Could that lead to a recession? Absolutely. That's what recessions are. So I'm not saying GDP is not going to go negative. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying it's not. I'm just saying in the long term, it's healthier. In the short term, absolutely it could be recessionary. In the long term, it's a benefit to both the employee and the company. All right, so that's my take. All right. Okay, so what else? Let's listen to Jimbo over here for a sec. Let's see what he has to say.
You're not going to get much about 2022 in there. Well, no, but it's 2021 is sort of where that data set ended.
The world stood still after that?
No, of course not. Of course not. But it can still be very helpful with a lot of different things.
No, it is. It's just that I'm getting pushback from people saying, Jim, you think that this is just going to be slotted in. It's just not going to happen as fast. So maybe that gives the muscle of the world a chance to catch their breath. This thing is not just electric.
It may. He's got a different approach, as he says, in terms of truth than
he
believes.
Is he worried about? Goebbels will take it over?
He's worried about the big thing, that the human species will be eradicated by an AI that gains consciousness and is
smarter. You can't shut it off. Tucker actually says you won't be able to shut it off.
Skynet.
It is. And we spent a lot of time in it. We've had plenty of guests who say we're way too focused on that. That's nowhere near where we are right now. That may very well be the case.
Okay, well, how about this?
Musk is not bad at sort of thinking about things into the future.
Side. Terrific.
I go back and forth. Yes, I disagree with him occasionally.
You're arbitrary and mercurial.
No, I'm not. I tend to just listen to him. I've always respected him from the point of view of a businessman.
Mr. Davis from Merck last night, talking about that this could be the way we're going to cure a lot of cancers
Meanwhile, you didn't take it here. This is where you should have taken it.
I was saving that for
NVIDIA.
We had a bet going how long it would take to Jim.
I deliberately missed NVIDIA.
What's wrong with you? Your brain is usually AI, NVIDIA.
I was trying to channel it into something more valuable.
All right.
We're going to get Cramer's Mad Dash in a minute, and we'll talk about this double upgrade for NVIDIA over at HSBC. Some pretty astounding revenue projections. Take a look at futures as we kick off the second trading day of the week. Don't go away.
Nice. All right. There's a segment that I want to cover from the Elon Tucker interview. So, Let's hit that segment, and then we're gonna we'll go to the course member live stream. I'm gonna have some more segment reactions coming later today. I'm not gonna be able to get all of the segment reactions to the Tucker interview, but got my second cup of coffee ready. 3:10. All right, so let's do this one, and then we'll do the other segments we'll post later today. So stay tuned for those, but they'll be trickling out throughout the day. Let me make sure I have it. Where is it? Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah, here we go. Oh, yeah, this is a good one. Wow, Elon Musk just threw Mark Zuckerberg under the bus, and it was a harsh throw, too. This was not a soft throw. There's the bus. I am grabbing you, making sure you are placed right under the wheel. And, oh, this was one of the most direct slams that I've seen by Elon Musk on another billionaire. And this one, let's just say Elon did not hold back an ounce. Take a listen to this clip. And then what we're going to do is fact check some of it. Let's listen in right here.
Do this. I know that Zuckerberg has said, and I take him at face value, that he. I do actually in this way, that he is a kind of old-fashioned liberal who doesn't like to censor. He has, but he, you know, like, why wouldn't a company like that take the stand that you have taken, which is pretty rooted in American traditional political custom, you know, for free speech?
My understanding is that Zuckerberg spent $400 million in the last election, nominally in a get-out-the-vote campaign, but really fundamentally in support of Democrats. Is that accurate or not accurate?
That is accurate. Yes.
Does that sound unbiased to you?
No, it doesn't.
Yes.
So you don't see hope that Facebook will approach this as a non-aligned arbiter?
Yeah, oops, oh man. That was a pretty big slam, and what I wanted to do was actually break this down. So the Associated Press did a fact check on this that ended up being totally biased. The Associated Press was like, no, that information isn't true. Mark didn't donate to Democrats. He donated to two nonpartisan organizations, the Center for Tech and Civic Life and the Center for Election Innovation Research. And boy, you're going to love some of the details on those companies. But let's just start with this. First of all, when I ran for governor in California, one of the things we quickly realized is the reason you have these organizations that exist is the way politics works is you cannot get an individual donation from somebody for more than a contribution limit. That limit, I think, is somewhere around $3,500. That means anything more than that needs to be funneled through some kind of political action committee or some kind of nonprofit. So the two nonprofits that Mark Zuckerberg donated nearly $400 million for are one, the Center for Tech and Civic Life, and the second I already mentioned, but I'll go through them individually now. So the Center for Tech and Civic Life is actually described as nonpartisan. And now in order to understand the background of the individuals who founded this company, you have to look at this one segment from a Washington Post piece 8 years ago. 8 years ago, the Washington Post tells you there's this company called the New Organizing Institute, or NOI. It's a basic democratic indoctrination boot camp. They say, it's an annual boot camp that gives rookies a basic set of skills, a crash course that helps them develop wider talent and knowledge infrastructure that many Democrats credit when discussing their technological gains in the last few election cycles. Blah, 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 blah. Basically, it's like a Mormon indoctrination camp. Instead of one of those you go to learn about how to be a Mormon and serve your mission, it's how to serve your mission as a Democrat, okay? And the three founders of this company, this alleged nonprofit organization, pretty much all worked for NOI. In fact, here's one of the three founders. Whitney May worked for the New Organizing Institute to work on voting information projects. But it's not just her. It's also the other co-founder, Tiana Epps Johnson. She ended up working for, guess what? Not only NOI, but also, look at this, folks, an Obama fellow in 2008 for 2 years. She was one of 20 out of 20,000 applicants to be an Obama fellow. And then you've got this other person named Donnie Bridges. Donnie Bridges, guess what? Where did Donnie Bridges happen to work? Oh, there it is. New Organizing Institute. So in other words, the three founders of one of the foundations that collected probably somewhere around half of that $400 million is run by three hardcore Democrats. The second, the Center for Election Innovation and Research, is founded by David Becker. You only have to go to his Twitter or Google his name and you find that he's described as a hardcore leftist who hates conservatives. All of these four folks that I've just described either graduated Stanford or Berkeley. All leftist institutions. So it kind of makes you scratch your head. Is that fair that Mark Zuckerberg donates $400 million to Democratic organizations? What say you? Now, I gotta go to the course member live stream. See you all in the next one. Goodbye, and thanks so much for watching.